hold, how long will teaching of evolution survive? Geology, by the way, has the same problem. I've been on nature tours where the guides refuse to talk about the origins of rock formations, saying that they've had problems with some religious guests. Oh, and given the growing importance of anti-vaccination posturing as a badge of conservative allegiance, how long before basic epidemiology, maybe even the germ theory of disease, gets the critical race theory treatment? And then there's economics, which these days is widely taught at high school level. Given the long history of politically driven attempts to prevent the teaching of Keynesian economics, what do you think the Florida Standard would do to teaching in my home field? The point is that the smear campaign against critical race theory is almost certainly the start of an attempt to subject education in general to rule by the right-wing thought police, which will have dire effects far beyond the specific topic of racism. And who will enforce the rules? State-sponsored vigilantes. Last month, Ron DeSantis, Florida's governor, proposed a Stop Woke Act that would empower parents to sue school districts they claim teach critical race theory and collect lawyer fees, a setup modeled under bounties under Texas's new anti-abortion law. Even the prospect of such lawsuits would have a chilling effect on teaching. Did I mention that Ron DeSantis also wants to create a special police force to investigate election fraud? Like the attacks on critical race theory, this is obviously an attempt to use a made-up issue, voter fraud is largely non-existent, as an excuse for intimidation. Okay, I'm sure that some people will say that I'm making too much of these issues, but ask yourself this. Has there been any point over, say, the last 5 years when warnings about right-wing extremism have proved overblown, and those dismissing those warnings as alarmists have been right?
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
I'm a teacher.
I'm a researcher.
I'm a mother.
I'm a lawyer.
And I believe in acting kindly toward you, because you are...
A Muslim lady.
You are very special. There's no one just like you. You are very special. And I'm so glad you're mine.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Dear listeners, thank you so very much for joining us on today's brand new episode of Muslim Lady. It is an honor and a pleasure to have you all with us. And of course, as always, I have the privilege of hosting my wonderful sister and awesome expert, Sister Razia Shamili. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, my full of energy friend.
Throughout these last few episodes, we've been talking about how to equip our girls with the mindset and skill set, basically, that they need in order to carry out their roles and responsibilities as adults.
So we were talking about the Quran attracts our attention to the topic of haya. I was actually reading a hadith from Lady Fatima salamullah alayha that she says, a woman is someone who does not see a non-mahram and a non-mahram does not see her.
That's the best thing for a woman.
That is the best thing for a woman. I was with a traditional practitioner one day, and she was saying that there are some physiological impacts, you know, coming with the eyes, you know, the energy that you send and the energy that you receive. I call it energy, but I don't know if I'm using the right term. But when you are with a non-mahram man, it affects the psychology of your body, your energy, the power of your eyes, your sexual
waves,
drive,
yeah.
Everything. It impacts it. Mm. The priority in all of us Muslim women's lives is that if it's possible for us to have this interaction with the non-mahram to the limited possible level, right?
Mm.
And if it's possible to have it no interactions with the non-mahram. But then, of course, the concept of hijab is there, that if you do have to go to the society, if you do have to interact to the minimum and, you know, cover your beauties and whatever that lies there. But these are all fruits of the upbringing of instilling haya in a person, right? It starts from a much younger age, before the time of conception, right? It starts with the food that the parents have eaten, if it is from halal money or not. So
absolutely.
Haya, the concept of modesty or chastity, starts from back then.
Mm-hmm.
And then all the way through the time that the mother is pregnant with her fetus, and how she thinks, how she feels, what she eats, where she goes, what she listens to, who she socializes with. All this have an impact on all the dimensions of that child, and including the modesty, the level of the modesty, right? No wonder they say that a person is shaqi in the womb of its mother, and a person is sa'id or prosperous in the womb of its mother, right? So everything, like the core of everything is there. So shaqi means
wretched.
Against opposite of sa'id, which is prosperous and happy and content.
Felicitous, yeah.
Right. The third level, when the child is born, they say that an adult couple who are having an intimate relationship together, even the sound of it should not be heard by a newborn child, as it affects the level of his or her chastity, right? So you see, Islam has very detailed guidelines about instilling haya in a person.
Sure.
Later on, when that child grows up, there is this beautiful verse in the Noble Quran that it says that you, as the parents, both of you, are responsible in telling your child what are your red boundaries. There are certain areas that are private to you, mom and dad, and your child will have to learn. And we're talking about 1400 years ago.
Mm.
It's not right now that there's this private realm of life, right? It is in chapter Nur, verse number 58, where it says, أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم يا أيها الذين آمنوا. O you who have faith. Two categories of people, your slaves, the people who work for you in your home, and any of you who have not reached puberty, so your children, will have to seek your permission three times in a day.
Now, by that, the verse doesn't mean that once they reach puberty, they don't have to ask permission anymore.
No. It says that these people will have to, the verse is going to answer your question. It says, before the dawn prayer, when you put off your garments at noon, after the night prayer. I'm assuming that after the night prayer, after the Isha prayer, people in the past used to recline and go to bed, right? In the middle of the night, they would wake up for nightly vigils, and then they would go to sleep again and have their private moments until it was the time of dawn. So after the Isha, you had to ask permission. And then before the dawn, you also have to... This is the period that parents are in the bedroom and they want to have their privacy. And you have to teach your child that when you want to enter, knock at the door.
You're listening to Muslim Lady and we're discussing how to... The practical steps of instilling haya and modesty per the teachings of Islam. However, we're going to be back after a short break, so stay with us.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Muslim Lady.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. You're listening to Muslim Lady, and we are talking about some interesting stuff on today's episode of the show. Thank you for joining us.
Aside from the two times that the children will have to knock at the door and ask permission for the from the parents because they are they have taken off their clothes, they're comfortable in their bedroom, and it's a sign of showing respect to parents and their privacy. And then these are three times of privacy for you. Apart from these, it is not sinful of you or them to frequent one another freely without asking permission to enter. But the question that if you have reached maturity, you would have to ask permission every time during the day where you want to enter your parents' room. But if you haven't reached maturity, these three specific moments, you have to ask permission. This is the fourth stage where you are raising your child and you are teaching him or her how to dress. Another stage where you have to teach your daughter about the concept of haya is that according to our hadith, hugging and kissing a girl has to be done with care and precaution, right?
Of course.
It's not like the girl is 14 and you're like, oh, this is my uncle, it's okay, he can see me without hijab. He has seen me growing up from a very young age.
Not her actual uncle.
No.
Because her actual uncle is okay.
Yeah, I think it was in the presence of one of the imams, I think it was fifth or sixth imam, where a fellow man hugged a 5 or 6 year old girl, and the imam told him that you know, it's now that she's growing up, you're not allowed to kiss her and put her on your lap which you used to do. These are instilling chastity and modesty into the girls. Also, the other point that is very important, because children learn through the lens of their parents.
For sure.
Through their lens of what they see their parents do. So what the woman wears inside, what the Muslim lady wears inside the house is of utmost importance. That she doesn't wear revealing clothes in front of her little ones, right? You shouldn't go into extremes. Islam is a religion of balance and moderation. So on the one hand, you see women wearing tops and shorts and revealing clothes in front of their like 7, 8 year old sons, especially if you have a son inside your house, or some other women who go to the other end of this extreme and they cover themselves up so bad, they are reflecting a very negative image of Islam. Their daughters,
a very negative image of being woman.
Exactly. And these women, their daughters grow up to be exactly opposite of them. They say, if this is Islam,
they're resentful.
Don't
want. Yeah.
Exactly. I've seen it in my life among the people that's, you know, some of the people that I socialize with. The mom is the exact opposite of all the daughters.
Yeah, see, this is exactly what we were talking about, where it's a cultural thing, but it's not an Islamic thing. It's a culture practiced by Muslims, but it's not an Islamic culture. Nowhere in Islam tells you to cover yourself up the same in front of a mahram, the same way you would in front of a non-mahram.
Exactly.
And I think those people also are unaware. Those people also need to be educated and need to be taught.
It's an offense to their relatives who see them always covered up. It's a cultural issue of even in Iran, some parts of there are some specific cultures who are like this.
Yeah.
And I don't know what the roots of that culture is, but even like there are so many little small segments of cultures in every city. Like even in one city, there are like hundreds of different cultures, right?
True.
So you always have to keep in mind the point of moderation and balance.
Yeah.
Not to go. And these are very important, as I said, for the upbringing of your little girls.
Yeah.
So this is another point that I wanted to mention.
Please send any suggestion, any idea to our email, that is englishradio@irib.ir.
There's so much more to talk about modesty and haya, and we were talking about the verses of the Quran that highlight the concept of haya. And I'm going to mention one more verse from the Noble Quran where it gives you the guideline of what if you're a Muslim mother or father and you want to know what Islam expects of you as a Muslim woman and expects of you, your daughters, this is the guideline to be a good woman.
Mm.
What is the criterion of being a good woman? We have talked about this verse so many times, but every time you can discuss it from a new dimension. The point is that from which direction are you looking at this verse this time? So it's verse 34 of Nisa.
Yep.
Your favorite verse. الرجال قوامون على النساء بما فضل بعضهم على بعض وبما أنفقوا من أموالهم فالصالحات قانتات حافظات. So the righteous women are obedient and they are حافظات. They are guardians. Guardians of what?
Their chastity.
One
their
of
honor.
Them is their own chastity, their own honor, and the honor and the wealth of their husbands. So here again, the Quran exactly sheds light on the fact that if you're a woman, you are supposed to be a hafiz, right?
And that's all the time we have for today's episode.
Right.
Thank you to Sister Razia for this interesting discourse. Until next time, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Who is the lover?
Allah.
Who is Ar-Rahman?
Allah.
Who is Al-Mannan?
La ilaha illallah. Muhammadur Rasulullah. Muhammad is the messenger. To Allah is our return.
The Quran, given by God to Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him and his family, more than 1400 years ago, as guidance for humanity.
La ilaha illallah.
Muhammadur Rasulullah.
Quran speaks about women.
The Quran teaches the equality of men and women in the eyes of Allah.
Chapter 33, verse 35.
All praise is due to the one and only. He is the master of all creation.
Modesty and chastity are encouraged by the Quran, both for women and for men.
Chapter 24, verses 30 and 31.
He is the sustainer and the maintainer of the whole universe.
God created us from one male and one female and made us into nations and tribes so that we make to know one another, not to despise each other.
Chapter 49, verse 13.
La ilaha illallah, Muhammadur Rasulullah. Muhammad is the messenger, to Allah is our return.
The Quran has indicated worthy women in history just as it has mentioned such men and has commended them greatly.
Chapter 3, verse 37.
Allahu Akbar, Allahu Akbar, Allahu Akbar.
food for thought. Hello everyone, and let us reflect on a statement by Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, regarding his immaculate daughter, Hazrat Fatima Zahra, peace be upon her. Surely my daughter Fatima is the leader of all women from the beginning to the end. She is part of me and the light of my eyes. She is the flower of my heart and is my soul. She is a human Huri, who whenever she stands in prayers in the presence of her Lord, exalted is his name, her light illuminates the skies for the angels, like stars shine to people on earth.
IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Cultural news, social news, scientific news, artistic news. With delight.
The most powerful telescope ever built in the world is now at its final destination in space. After traveling for nearly 1 month, NASA's James Webb Space Telescope has reached its final parking spot in space, which is approximately 1 million miles away from Earth. The mission of the tennis court-sized telescope is to explore the cosmos and better understand the early days of the universe. The $10 billion telescope will also carefully monitor faraway exoplanets and study the atmospheres of planets outside our solar system. It's more advanced than NASA's iconic Hubble telescope. Now, with the Chinese New Year approaching, a Vietnamese artist is honoring the zodiac sign of 2022 by making different objects that look like tigers.
I often introduce collections for the zodiac animal of the next year. It's going to be the year of the tiger soon. There are 2022 carvings in this collection, which align with the number of this year. Also, I am very fond of tigers as an animal, as they are so powerful, yet so majestic.
Tam Pat has his workshop in a village on the outskirts of the capital, Hanoi. The 39-year-old artist makes tigers using wood from jackfruit trees, which Vietnamese often use to make spiritual items. He applies crushed eggshells and seashells to give shape to the tiger's stripes. The artist is also carving some tigers purely out of laterite, the mineral still used in some villages to build homes. It takes Tampat about 2 weeks to come up with a tiger-looking object. This year, he is trying to make his creations in a way that can be used in everyday life. The house in Colombia has become a hotspot for tourists. It's built in a unique way, and if you want to enter the house, you have to first walk on the ceiling leading to the door. The upside-down house is named Casa Loca and is located in Guatavita, a short distance from the capital, Bogota. Tourists can be seen walking around taking pictures of this exceptional structure. Many say it fills them with joy to visit such places. Some tourists say this has provided them a chance to gain some relief from the struggles of the pandemic.
We've come from a pandemic. We've emerged from a lockdown. So this helps people have a moment of relaxation with the novelty that we did not have. You have fun while snapping photos. It puts your mind at ease.
The Austrian creator of Casa Loca says he first got the idea to build a house when he was visiting a similar place in his country back in 2015. He says his grandchildren were stunned by the creation, and that's why he decided to make an upside-down house in Colombia, where he lives now. He says people initially thought he was mad, but he decided to accomplish his plan anyway. The pandemic slowed him down a bit, but he proudly inaugurated the place 3 weeks ago.
Iran has won the first title in team category of the 20th Pan Pacific Abacus and Mental Arithmetic Championship. Saman Kujuri has more.
Talented Iranian children have ranked first in team category of the 20th Pan-Pacific Abacus and Mental Arithmetic Association Global Abacus and Mental Arithmetic Championships, which was held online. Children in five different age groups, including age 5 to 7 as Group A, 8 to 9 Group B, 10 to 11 Group C, 12 to 14 Group D, and 15 or older in Group E, annually attend the contest solving multiple math equations, including division, multiplication, square roots, cube roots, fractions, time, and etc. 572 students from 21 member states participated at the event.
Iranian students have won the title of Champion of the Champions in two categories. Moreover, they won titles in all categories, including Champion of Champions titles, Champion titles, First Winners, and the Second Winner titles. In 2023, Iran will host the 22nd edition of the Pan-Pacific Abacus and Mental Arithmetic Association Global Abacus and Mental Arithmetic Championships.
The Smart Kids Institute holds a national competition annually in August to select members of the Iranian team for attending the PALMA Global Abacus Championships. Children from 17 to 13 years of age take part in the competition to solve some 7 mathematical test sheets using abacuses.
I am 12 years old. I have won the first title in this round of the international competitions. I have been practicing with abacus for 4 years. In the competitions, we had to solve multiple math equations, including division, multiplication, square root, and etc.
My math teacher encouraged me to learn abacus 5 years ago. Abacus and mental arithmetic skills had great impact on my mental growth and helped me a lot in my math lessons.
The championship, organized by a non-profit organization established in 1999, is an example of what can be achieved with early intervention in abacus math and mental arithmetic education.
The purpose of the competition is to allow for observation of mental arithmetic skills from countries around the world and to promote related education to find new talents in this field. Saman Kujuri, Tehran.
Traveling around the world is a wish a lot of people have, but never actually get the chance.
However, the Belgian-British girl has achieved that feat at only 19. Zora Rutherford flew back home on Thursday to a crowd made up of family members, friends, fans, and journalists. She completed her odyssey after just over 5 months, traveling over 52,000 kilometers. Zora is the youngest female in the world to fly around the globe. She achieved this using a microlight aircraft, which weighs only 325 kilograms and has very low fuel consumptions. That's absolutely amazing. Let's take a listen.
Right, the plane obviously is a bad for the environment. I'm not trying to claim that it is. But I have chosen one of the best aircraft to do it with. The fuel consumption is amazing. For this whole trip, it's used the same amount of fuel as a Boeing uses in about 10 minutes for the whole trip around the world, which I think puts things into perspective. Obviously, it is bad, but I'm really trying to minimize my impact as much as possible.
Zora says the scariest part of her trip was flying over the frozen expanse of Siberia, a place with no human habitation close by. The teen adventurer also had to deal with different countries' health restrictions. Zora had to take multiple PCR tests on her journey, while China's COVID-related regulations meant she could not use the country's airspace. Now, Zora says she is glad she can stay in one place for a few months. Who knows what her next adventure will be?
The Light is a bulletin in which we bring you a lot of interesting news in different fields like animals' life, cultural events, funny trending news, and more from every corner of the world.
In the world of art, a Japanese artist named Sachi is creating incredibly realistic felted wool portraits of cats. Sachi calls her artworks Wakuneko, which directly translates to frame cat. Her work is highly popular, and she has more than 600,000 followers on different social media platforms. Each portrait takes a whopping 1 month to complete. The crafting process starts with Sachi looking at dozens of photos of the cat she wants to replicate. Then she prepares the required materials before preparing the foundation and mounts the felt onto it. The most difficult part of the job is making the subject's eyes. According to Sachi, it is also the most special stage.
I think that the moment when the cat's spirit enters into the artwork can be presented through the eyes. In that sense, I have been very particular about how to make the eyes.
Sachi's portraits have inspired people around the world to adopt homeless cats. Now she hopes to hold an exhibition showing various cats, including ones with physical handicaps, in order to inspire more adoptions of shelter cats.
Disability is not an obstacle to success. A group of Japanese with disabilities has proved it as they create incredible handicraft and make a living this way. A shop called Amayaka offers the items made by these disabled individuals. Located in a Tokyo neighborhood, it showcases products ranging from scarves and bags to glassware and colorful carts. Mayaka and all other workshops are part of a new movement aimed at promoting works of people with impairment. In just one of the workshops cooperating with Mayaka, about 20 disabled people are working over there. However, organizers of the movement say these people are still invisible in the society and are not paid fairly for their works despite being experienced in craftsmanship.
Some workers here have a career of more than 30 years. They have been weaving since their school days. They are so experienced that we should refer to them as artisans.
The organizers say they hope that their initiative will promote the works of the people with disabilities and help the society to start thinking about the way disabled workers are being treated. turtles get a second chance to spread their fins after being found with bellies full of plastic. They were rescued and are now being released back to the sea in Argentina. Two green turtles and four loggerhead turtles were saved from fishing nets in Buenos Aires province. The group was taken to Grupo Marina Foundation, where they recuperated after purging 10 types of plastic from their bodies. Rehabilitation of the turtles lasted over a month and included blood tests and other procedures to make sure they were free of plastic. A biologist with a foundation says the danger of plastic is that it's silent, and usually its dangers are so gradual that it goes unnoticed.
Many times the animal appears to be in perfect health. However, during the checkup and evaluation, we found a large amount of this material inside. So it is important to get rid of the plastic before the condition worsens and it ends up causing the deaths of the specimens.
The turtles had mistakenly eaten plastic, thinking it was food. Wind, waves, and sunshine break down discarded plastic into tiny pieces, which litter ocean waters. Much of this plastic waste can be found on beds of seaweed that turtles forage for food. This trash ends up fatally clogging their bellies, causing the decline in the population of these graceful reptiles. The Indian administered Kashmir has the world's only floating post office. A 200-year-old houseboat on a famous Dal Lake in Srinagar, set up during the British rule in India. The post office has survived throughout the years because of its charm. Our correspondent Shahana Bhatt has more.
The Indian administered Kashmir was once a princely independent state, out of bounds for outsiders. As the ruler of Jammu and Kashmir, this allowed non-locals to own property in this picturesque region. During the British rule in the Indian subcontinent, many Britons tried to find an alternative way of living in Kashmir. Thus, houseboat on the world-famous Dal Lake came into existence. Today, the lake is a home to hundreds of such boats, which are a major attraction for tourists around the globe. This one is a unique boat, the only floating post office in the whole world. This is a 200-year-old boat built by the British. It has truly stood the test of time, as it still functions.
Post office, Dal Lake.
This is not an ordinary post office. We're standing on a heritage property. I've enjoyed my work since the very first day I came here. It's a unique experience to be working here. And every day, I get the chance to meet people from different corners of the world.
The boat is not limited to postal services. It also has a small museum where colorful stamps from the 1980s are put to display, along with a collection of rare philately stamps. The post office is a hot tourist destination in the region. Locals also come to this post office to send postcards to their loved ones, inviting them to visit Kashmir.
Floating post office.
In the age of technology, electronic mails, e-cards and other internet applications have made it extremely easy for people to communicate. But sending a postcard from this floating post office gives one a really different feeling.
The floating post office underwent reconstruction in 2011 and is currently a part of the Indian postal system. Recently, the office started offering banking services, thus attracting more locals.
I have opened an account here for my daughter. It's hassle-free and this place suits my mind. It's not like the usual offices. Visiting this place with kids is like a trip.
Yet another attraction of this post office is this souvenir shop, from where everyone can buy postcards, stamps, traditional crafts and greeting cards.
This floating post office in Kashmir's Dal Lake is like a time machine. It brings people back to two centuries ago and shows them the history of the beautiful region. Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Today's special.
Assalamu alaikum.
It's special for you. We present to you today. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim, in the name of Allah the Almighty. Dear brothers and sisters, Salamun Alaikum. Peace and salutations of Allah be upon all of you, dear friends. You're listening to IRIB English Radio, and this program today is special. We're going to speak about consultation in Islam. Today, Thursday, is the 24th of Jamadi al-Thani, 1443, of the Islamic Lunar Hijri calendar, corresponding to the 7th of Bahman, 1400 of the Islamic Solar Hijri calendar, and the 27th of January, 2022, of the Christian Gregorian calendar. Dear friend, today we'll listen to chapter Shura, verse 38. All together.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم والذين استجابوا لربهم وأقاموا الصلاة وأمرهم شورى بينهم ومما رزقناهم ينفقون.
And those who have responded to their Lord and established prayer, and whose affair is determined by consultation among themselves, and from what we have provided them, they spend.
La ilaha illallah, la ilaha illallah.
Bless your day with contemplation on the verses of the Holy Quran.
It is worthy of note that one is supposed to seek consultation regarding the affairs of people, but one is not supposed to do likewise concerning divine matters. They are resurrection, imamate, and worship of Allah. Establishment of prayers is a divine covenant, and believers are supposed to keep their promise without seeking consultation. Imamate and leading the Muslim community are also divine covenant, since Prophet Ibrahim invoked Allah Almighty and asked him to appoint his offspring to lead the community, and Allah Almighty answered to him. Leadership and imamate are my covenant and appointment of individuals to the same is dependent upon my will rather than your invocation, since wrongdoers do not deserve leadership.
You could easily take away everything you've given me, and I try to remember not to take anything for granted, 'cause I know that one day suddenly this will all come to an end. So my last wish is for you.
Consultation in Islam from IRIB English Radio, and this program today is special. Although the Holy Prophet of Islam followed revelation in the injunctions which were descended by Allah, he always asked the opinion of Muslims in the matter of implementing laws. Prophet Muhammad, as the leader of the society, was assigned by Allah to consult with Muslims, and his conduct in every affair of life was based on consultation. In hadith and narrations of the Holy Prophet of Islam and the infallible Imams, importance of consultations has been stressed, and they have encouraged Muslims to talk and exchange views with conscious individuals. It has been said that the soundness of decision making lies in consultation. Basically, those who consult with others make fewer mistakes. Conversely, those who are egoistic and consider themselves needless of thoughts of others often make dangerous mistakes, even though they enjoy extraordinary intellect. Dr. Fakhr Rohani.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim wa binasta'in. In this episode, we are going to be concerned with the role and effect of consultation in Islam. What's important in this regard is that at times, taking a decision, without consultation, may result in ruining a situation. And it's really very praiseworthy, it's a praiseworthy act to receive consultations from others. But there's one point. In order to receive consultation, one has to find out, those people who are fair-minded, they are really experienced, they are pious, and they don't want to betray someone else. Because not all people should be approached for consultation. Imagine that, for example, you've got a fridge at home and this fridge doesn't operate well. Certainly, you wouldn't go to a medical doctor in order to repair that fridge. You go to the right person for that. Or, for example, if someone feels unwell, this person is usually suggested to go to a medical doctor. Suppose that a person who is in need of a medical doctor goes to an engineer. It isn't the right way, and it isn't the right practice. At the same time, what's important in this regard is that, we have to find out, which person deserves being approached in order to make use of and benefit from the suggestions of the consultations and so on.
Reflecting on different Islamic topics, short commentary of the Holy Quran, hadiths of the infallibles, lessons from the life of the infallibles, all in today's special from IRIB English Radio.
Counselors, honesty, and trustworthiness is the title of this part. I invite you to join us. Imam Sadiq, peace be upon him, said, a man went to see Imam Ali and said, I have come to seek your advice and that of Hussein, and Abdullah ibn Jafar about marriage. The blessed Imam Ali said, one whose advice is sought is a confidant. Then he told the man his viewpoints. We read that Imam Sadiq said, one whose brother seeks counsel from him and he does not counsel him with sincerity, Allah will deprive him of his soundness in judgment. One whose advice is sought is trustworthy. Therefore, he will never cheat one. Therefore, one who seeks advice should never accuse the one whose advice he seeks. Secondly, the one whose advice is sought should sincerely express whatever he thinks.
I see you in the wings that chase the night, circling the warmth of candlelight. I hear you in the wind as the two poles spin, whispering the truth your heart holds in. I feel you in the chill as the seasons turn, laying down a seed with its lessons learned. The circle spins a perfect line, free from borders, free from time. I close my eyes and clear my mind. The circle joins your love with mine.
One important sentence: believers advise each other. Imam Sadiq, peace be upon him, said, "It is incumbent upon a believer to give sincere counsel to another believer." The late Allama Majlisi, Islamic great scholar, said, "What is meant by advice is guiding them to improve their religious and worldly affairs, and training the ignorant people to fend off harm from them and bring them some benefits. If they do not accept your advice, you have shown your good intentions by advising them to do good deeds and refrain from evil acts." The noble Prophet of Allah said, "Each of you should give sincere advice to your brethren, just as you give sincere advice to yourselves."
Shura, God is not going to consult the people regarding that matter, is the concept of what? Imam and Khilafah. Allah says, "I decide who is going to be the Imam, the Caliph." Yes, you can choose your president, your prime minister, but when it comes to Khalifa and Imam, this is my job, this is my area, this is my jurisdiction. I don't leave it for you to decide. وَرَبُّكَ يَخْلُقُ مَا يَشَاءُ وَيَخْتَارُ 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 means لِلْخِلَافَ لِلْإِمَامَ وَيَخْتَارُ مَا كَانَ لَهُمُ الْخِيَرَةُ مِنْ أَمْرِهِمْ. I don't leave the khiyara means the choice for people to decide, because people are going to fight. This is exactly what happened after the Prophet. Bani Taim, they want Abu Bakr to be the leader. Bani Uday, they want Umar to be the leader. Bani Ansar, they want this guy. And there was a fist fight inside Sa'if, a fist fight. Nobody knows about it. 99.9% of the Muslims, they don't read their history. Believe me, they don't read their history. They don't know what happened. But when you read it in a book, people got together after the death of the Prophet and they appointed Fulan, and he became caliph. Congratulations, and people started clapping. And it's not like that. There was a fist fight inside Saqifa. There were violence. People don't know. This is not consultation. This is not consultation. So that is not open. Why? Because God says this belongs to me. And what is the meaning of consultation? Does it mean that the whole people, let's say we are voting here, all people here unanimously should agree over one thing, or the majority of them? Because unanimity, it's sometimes impossible. Sometimes impossible. Even if you bring five people and you bring up an issue, one of them, two of them are going to have different opinion. So always you cannot have all people accept one opinion or one person or one concept. Definitely there will be disagreement. God says the majority. Ask the majority of them. This is real democracy. Majority.
Dear brothers and sisters, that was all for today's special from IRIB English Radio. Inshallah, we join you in another episode. Till then, we leave you in Allah's blessings. Have a nice time.
They told me that I'm crazy, who you're praying for? They told me there is nothing, who you're looking for? Stop doing what you're doing, cause there is no hope. Just come with me, I'll show you what's behind your door. And they showed me all kind of lies.
eyes were locked, yes, I was mesmerized. But deep inside, I know that there's a better world. 'Cause I'm a believer. I'm a believer.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.